This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson, and President Joe Biden is promising a full-scale wartime effort to fight the coronavirus pandemic. He wants 100 million people vaccinated in 100 days, but he says defeating the virus won't be quick or easy.
I understand the despair and frustration of so many Americans and how they're feeling. I understand why many governors, mayors, county officials, tribal leaders feel like they're left on their own without a clear national plan to get them through the crisis. Let me be very clear. Things are going to continue to get worse before they get better.
While the initial rollout of the vaccines was marred by lack of coordination and shortages, they were developed in record time. That's one bright spot during a year of darkness. Today, we're going to hear stories on how people have persevered and found their own bright spots. First, the story of frontline healthcare workers who began receiving the vaccine last month. Dr. Tyson Bell is one of them. He's a critical care and infectious disease doctor in Charlottesville, Virginia. We're going to tag along with him on the day he went in for his vaccination.
How did everyone sleep?
Ruby slept terribly. Elaine slept okay.
I slept great.
Down.
This is Tyson's family, his wife Kristen, his two-year-old daughter Ruby.
Mommy froze the milk.
And his seven-year-old son, Elaine. They're having breakfast before Tyson heads to work to receive his vaccine. He directs the intensive care unit at UVA Health and treats patients with the most severe cases of COVID-19.
Taking care of COVID-19 patients has been one of the hardest things I've ever had to do.
He's watched patients have to be put on ventilators, knowing some would never come off.
You get so emotionally attached to patients that it can be hard sometimes when you can anticipate what's going to happen.
He doesn't just deal with the virus at work. It's everywhere around him.
On my drive home, I call family members who have COVID-19 and may be at home, but I'm worried that they're going to end up in the same boat at some point, and that's incredibly stressful. And this is just another layer of complexity that just intersects with, you know, every aspect of your life. And so it feels like you can't actually escape it sometimes.
COVID-19 has changed a lot for his family. He's working from home more, his kids are in a virtual school, and his mother-in-law comes to the house to help out a couple days a week. Tyson says he's stretched to the limit. At the hospital, he's working with patients who are sometimes too sick to discuss their own treatment.
One of the things that happens a lot of times in the ICU is people come in extremely sick from the get-go, and they may have tubes and all sorts of machines hooked up to them, and they're not speaking with you. And in a sense, you know, I'll just be honest, there's a dehumanizing aspect to it, to where if you don't know someone's voice and their backstory, sometimes you don't make as firm of a connection with these patients.
He worries about his patients, but also whether he's putting his family at risk. He lives in constant fear of bringing the coronavirus home to them.
So I've talked to my children about the coronavirus and the fact that it's caused so much problem in the country and the world. You know, some days are really tough, but I share all that with my children.
Tomorrow I'm going to get the vaccine against coronavirus.
When I talk with them about the fact that I'm getting a vaccine last evening,
it's gonna work.
Yeah.
No, they fully understood the gravity of that and what that meant.
But is it just a test?
Nope, they've done the experiments already.
So now there's a real vaccine.
There's a real vaccine?
Yay. Does it hurt?
It probably will hurt, but only for a little bit.
It can get a real pinch.
Yeah, a little pinch, but then it'll feel better soon after that.
And I'll kiss it?
Yeah, you can kiss it, like, Mickey.
As a black man, Tyson says it's been especially hard when he looks around the ICU and sees himself, his community, in the faces of his patients. He noticed it early in the pandemic.
There was a day I was rounding in the ICU and just trying to get through the work of the day. And we were on morning rounds, and I realized that one section of the ICU was almost all Hispanic patients, Hispanic last names, and then the other section was almost all black names and families that I knew and recognized. And I was trying to just get through the day and trying to, you know, do what I'm supposed to do, but it felt so weighty on my shoulders that I had to stop my team and just say, you know, guys, I just have to say that it is incredibly hard to see the toll that this has taken on the minority community and to see people who, you know, to see such a high proportion of our patients who are sick from these communities is personally really tough. So I'm on my way now to get the coronavirus vaccine.
Tyson arrived at UVA Health to receive his first dose. He walked down the halls of what's usually the cancer treatment wing, past large windows with bright sun streaming in.
There's something that I need to admit, just in the interest of full transparency. I don't like shots. It's not vaccines in particular. I love vaccines. I just don't like needles. Can't stand them. Even though I'm looking very much forward to getting this vaccine, I'm not looking forward to the actual needle.
Finally, it was time for the injection. Justin, a hospital pharmacist, puts on his rubber gloves and takes the syringe out of the package. He preps the vaccine and slowly draws Tyson's dose from the vial.
Okay, you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Can I just relax your arm as much as you can?
I'll try. All
right. Here we go. 1, 2, 3.
Oh, wow.
And it is done.
They thanked us for what we were doing, which felt really great. And then he gave me the vaccine and, you know, just this big handshake that, you know, you just felt the strength and the gravity of that moment.
You did
Thank
great.
You, sir.
Yeah, good to meet
Thank
you, man.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, too. So it was fantastic. All of these complex feelings and emotions, you know, all really came to a head the moment that vaccine went into my arm. And I finally had this feeling that, you know, there's a way to lift this now, that we can finally turn the corner on this. Reminds me of this song by Nina Simone, Feeling Good. And I love this song because it's really exemplifies the transition that I've felt today.
It's a new dawn, it's a new day.
We've been through so much darkness and it's been so hard for everyone. I think everyone's been affected by this. But this vaccine is the key to a new day.
It's a new life for me, yeah.
And this is how we step into the future. And we have to go boldly because there's a lot of work to be done. But watch out.
And I'm feeling good.
Tyson received his second dose of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine in early January. The new day Tyson was talking about got here a lot sooner than anyone expected. Dr. Anthony Fauci predicted it would take up to 18 months to develop a vaccine. Scientists did it in about half that time. Billions of dollars from the U.S. government and philanthropists played a big part. But so did a revolution in the way scientists share information about their discoveries. In the face of a global crisis, many more scientists started posting their findings on the internet in real time. Breakthroughs are coming faster, and collaboration is happening in a field that usually thrives off competition. Michelle Avisar Whiting is the editor-in-chief of Research Square, a website where scientists can quickly share their work. Michelle, thanks so much for talking to me.
Nice to see you, Al.
Tell me if I got this right. So traditionally, scientific research goes through a process called peer review. Scientists submit their findings to a journal to be published. Then different scientists weigh in on the work. It's a long, arduous process that can take years before the scientific community or the public knows what they've discovered. During a pandemic, does that system still work?
Really, the pandemic has made a mockery out of that traditional publishing system. That idea seems really outdated even outside of the pandemic, but with the pandemic happening, that's preposterous, right? That it could take that long. I think that everyone sort of saw that and said, we need to get these results out now. That is exactly why we're seeing this unprecedented, you know, emergence of both treatments and now vaccines for the COVID-19 virus. It's only by virtue of all that research having been shared really, really early on through preprints.
What exactly are preprints?
The preprint is just the early version of that paper that then the author submits to a journal and it gets peer-reviewed and considered by an editor for publication.
We spoke with a German researcher who published a preprint on your website in May, Dr. Julianne Walls.
To be honest, we've never published preprints before. We decided to publish it early to make it available to a lot of people.
Her lab has been working on a COVID vaccine. It's now in clinical trials, but to get to that point, she had to first identify the small parts of the coronavirus that trigger an immune response. She wanted to get her findings out fast. Also, she didn't want another scientist to beat her to publishing first, but she was surprised at what happened afterwards.
This really led to interesting collaborations with researchers worldwide. So we have now a collaboration with people from Ireland and with guys from Thailand and Indonesia. So, I think this was a really huge benefit.
But there are risks, too. Dr. Wall says that one of her findings was picked up a lot on social media and people either didn't understand it or intentionally cherry-picked her research to push herd immunity as a way to fight the virus.
A lot of people interpreted the work and said, okay, then we don't need any masks, we don't need any lockdown because 81% of all people are already immune and have immunity and could not get infected, which is absolutely not true.
So Michelle, what do you think was motivating the social media posts?
Total misinterpretation of a very complex story. People who have an interest in pushing the narrative around herd immunity, that we already have immunity to this virus and everybody is overreacting and we shouldn't be shutting the economy down and we shouldn't be closing restaurants and closing schools and all of that, have found that little snippet useful to push that narrative, even though it's false, even though it's misleading.
So looking at the growth you're seeing in preprint submissions, what does that mean for science at large? I ask you this because I have a dear family member who's dealing with a long-term illness, a long-term fatal illness. They're always checking in to see what new research is coming out, what treatments are available and things of that nature. And it's always so slow. I'm just curious if, like, you know, preprints could possibly speed up that system.
That's exactly the hope. And beyond just speeding up the system, what I'm hoping is that it makes it more rigorous and improves the system over time. Because if we move to this system where everything is free to read and accessible to read right up front, and then we open that research to really anyone to scrutinize, right? I think that this opens us up to, you know, a world where we can have perhaps more faith in the science that ends up being endorsed. So hopefully we do see faster progress and more collaboration around, you know, these terrible diseases.
Yeah, this kind of feels like a revolution in science. Like, you know, everything is changing here. Paradigm shift.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think we're witnessing the very beginning of a fundamental shift in the way that research is published.
So given that, you think preprints are here to stay?
I think so, yep.
Michelle Avisar Whiting is the editor-in-chief at Research Square. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Thanks, Al. It was great to talk to you.
What other changes could be on the horizon for science in 2021? One major shift has to do with who's in the White House.
Trump's administration endless 4 years of anti-science, of rolling back environmental protections from air quality to water quality to risk management to agricultural workers.
That's Dr. Jacoby Wilson. He's an associate professor of environmental health at the University of Maryland and advises the EPA as a member of its National Environmental Justice Advisory Council. I first interviewed him in 2019 about how Trump's policies disproportionately hurt people of color. With Joe Biden in office, change is already coming. On his inauguration day, Biden signed an executive order targeting many of Trump's environmental rollbacks. He also canceled construction of the Keystone Oil Pipeline and moved to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. And just this past week, Biden announced new intra-agency environmental justice councils at the White House.
Environmental justice will be at the center of all we do, addressing the disproportionate health and environmental and economic impacts on communities of color, so-called fence line communities, especially those communities, brown, black, Native American, poor whites. It's hard, the hard-hit areas, like Cancer Alley in Louisiana, or the Route 9 corridor in the state of Delaware. That's why we're going to work to make sure that they receive 40% of the benefits of key federal investments in clean energy, clean water, and wastewater infrastructure. Lifting up these communities makes us all stronger as a nation and increases the health of everybody.
I spoke to Dr. Wilson before this announcement was made to ask him what he expects from a Biden presidency. What a few weeks it's been, am I right?
That's right.
So Biden named a Native American woman, New Mexico Representative Deborah Holland, as his Interior Secretary nominee. He picked a black man who heads North Carolina's environmental agency, Michael Regan, to head the EPA, and a black woman, Brenda Mallory, to lead his White House Council on Environmental Quality. Is the door open now for progress on environmental justice?
You're seeing a commitment to diversity, yes, and inclusion. You're seeing a commitment to folks who have experience, because the Obama administration made some progress around environmental justice, but I think the work of this administration could be transformative for decades. And you have to do a lot of work to make up for hundreds of years of neglect, of injustice, of racism, of white supremacy as pertains to who is able to access clean air and clean water and who's not. We want to make sure our communities are also equally protected when it comes to environmental rules and regulations, and that hasn't happened to this point.
What kinds of concrete things could change under these new leaders?
Yeah, when you think about environmental justice, which is really talking about how some communities are overburdened by environmental hazards, you know, landfills, chemical plants, factories, refineries, when you have too many facilities, we're not going to add another facility. We can say no to bringing in new facilities. This administration is going to put more focus on those who are most vulnerable.
So you've been working in environmental justice, and I understand that some of the breakthrough work you've personally done was in Charleston, South Carolina, about a decade ago. They were planning to expand the port there, and a black community near the port used an innovative way to get federal money to deal with pollution problems. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, the big issue in Charleston is you have the Port of Charleston is going to expand, right? But even beyond the port expansion, there was already a lot of environmental hazards in North Charleston, which is primarily, you know, black folks, low-wealth folks. They have multiple Superfund sites. They have leaking underground storage tanks. You know, you're storing, you know, fuels on the ground, right? And those tanks leak. Brownfield issues, metal recyclers. And you also had an incinerator. So the county's incinerator was also in this community. And you add on top of that all the truck traffic, so the diesel particulates, right, the soot. So you've been overburdened by hazards, and you have poor infrastructure.
What were you able to do to correct all that or to begin working on it?
Yeah, so when I was assistant professor at the University of South Carolina, I began working with the Lowcountry Alliance for Model Communities in 2007. So what we were able to do was build a community university partnership to train residents to collect their own air quality data. So this partnership actually led to that incinerator being shut down.
And how did federal law help you protect the community?
North Charleston was actually the first community in the country to use NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, to get mitigation dollars. No one had ever done it before. And so they were able to get $4 million to mitigate the impacts from the planned expansion of the port. And so the fact that the community was able to do that was actually groundbreaking. And that community group, in many ways, has been a model for how you can use NEPA in other parts of the country.
So last year, Vice President Kamala Harris sponsored an environmental justice bill in the Senate. It didn't pass, but it would have made it easier to help communities that suffer from multiple sources of pollution. Do you think she'll try to push to prioritize issues around environmental racism?
I wholeheartedly believe that Vice President Harris is going to push Biden on this. And I actually wrote a blog. I actually said, would Biden be the first climate justice president? Because if he's able to do through executive power and through the Senate, you can see transformation, not just reform and incrementalism, real transformation, real revolution, and real impacts for communities who've been really let down by the EPA, by just being used as sacrifice zones for, you know, multiple decades.
You know, one of the things I think about when we talk about environmental racism is that when we're just talking about racism in general, in a lot of ways, especially if you are not experiencing that racism, and just to be clear, if you're not Black, if you're not Indigenous, if you're not, you know, a person of color, a lot of times seeing that racism is hard for people. And I think it's twice that effect when you're talking about environmental racism, because a lot of the factors that cause communities to be polluted can't really be seen. Like, if you're driving by a Superfund site, you may not know it's a Superfund site unless there is a big sign that says, hey, this happened here. So I guess the question I have is, how do we make change, not from a political standpoint, but from a human standpoint, from a societal standpoint? How do we shift the paradigm for people to understand that these things are real and that the most vulnerable are always the minorities in any nation?
As someone who grew up in Mississippi, I remember the first racist incident I experienced as a five-year-old, right? I remember, you know, being called the N-word playing soccer and playing baseball. I remember getting fights over the N-word, right? Being suspended from school when someone called me the N-word and they got a slap on the wrist, right? And so that pain is part of me, right? That trauma, I carry that with me. You have people who experience the trauma of police brutality, of being over-sentenced. Folks experience the trauma of their kids, the school to prison pipeline. That's trauma, right? We should be able to see that trauma. And we should also be able to see that trauma in the state-sanctioned poisoning of communities of color. What happened in Flint, for example, with the Flint water crisis, wouldn't happen in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You wouldn't dare put a landfill or incinerator in Bethesda, Maryland, but you have the Willowbrand incinerator in Curtis Bay, Baltimore, right? We can make that more visible by people understanding, seeing the data is one way to make it more visible. Science can play a role. We have to make science more inclusive. By making more science more inclusive, we make it more approachable. We make people understand how the value of science and how they can use science, right? Knowledge is power. And I think with that knowledge, we can make environmental injustice, environmental racism more visible in this country.
While Biden was on the campaign trail, he wouldn't ban fracking for oil and gas. Now that he's the president, does that worry you?
I think he made a political move. He didn't want to lose Pennsylvania. I think that administration knows who's been impacted by those operations. Not the wealthy and not people like me. It's folks who look like me. So the policies have to be overhauled, right? So fracking has to go, oil and gas has to go, and we can replace those things if we can invest in climate opportunities and we invest in infrastructure and we focus on equity and justice.
So tell me, what gives you hope about the work you're going to do going forward?
One of the things that really excited me with the protests, you know, with the uprising against racism and the fight for Black lives in this country and globally, is sending all the young folks out there who are protesting. And, you know, I think doing science is great and being a scientist is great, but my most important job is not to do great science. My most important job is to train the next generation of scientists. And so I think with this new administration, the emphasis on climate change and environmental justice, that will inspire more young folks to want to get careers in these fields. And so that gives me hope.
Dr. Jacoby Wilson, thank you so much for speaking with me again.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Reveal's Elizabeth Shogren and Najib Amini produced our story. The massive Black Lives Matter protests that erupted last summer were built on the persistent hard work of longtime activists. It's about much more than a call to defund the police.
It's really seeking to look at how we can give that person care in the community as opposed to incarceration at every point in the system.
That's coming up next on Reveal.
For Reveal comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. The pandemic has led to shifts in areas of society that have been historically resistant to change, like the criminal justice system. While prisons all over the country have been rightly criticized for failing to protect staff and inmates from infection, many local jails have been decarcerating at unprecedented levels. It's something that reform advocates have been calling for a long time and is intertwined with the goals of the Black Lives Matter movement that surged last year. Calls to defund the police got a lot of attention. But beyond that, protesters were demanding that law enforcement budgets be shifted to other services that need more funding, like education, social services, and mental health care. Right now, people with mental health issues tend to end up behind bars. We can see that because in 44 states, jails and prisons are the largest mental health care providers. And the largest mental health care facility in the country is the Twin Towers Jail in Los Angeles County. Residents there made a vote for change last November by passing Measure J. It will put hundreds of millions of dollars towards alternatives to incarceration. If it works, it could be a model for redirecting money from the police into other services. Reporter Andrew Stelzer has more.
The massive Twin Towers jail is only a 20-minute drive from Antonieta Zuniga's house. She lives in Pico Rivera in southeast L.A. County.
I love all my grandkids and my kids, you know, but Carlos was very special for me since he born.
Antonieta's grandson, Carlos Jr., was born in 1993. In his early teens, he began exhibiting signs of schizophrenia, hearing voices and police sirens.
He was living with his mother when everything starts. He started like at 13, 14 years old.
By the time he turned 18, Carlos had been in and out of the hospital several times. The family really didn't know what to do. But his mom couldn't deal with it anymore. So grandma opened her doors.
And of course, you know, I was naive. I don't know nothing about mental illness until, you know, I saw so many strange things. It's when I said, wow.
Over the next 8 years, Antonieta learned a lot. Carlos would randomly move furniture around the house or use meth and disappear for days at a time. But she did her best to keep up.
It's very hard to handle a situation when you're not a doctor, when you're not a nurse. But he's very respectful with me. He loves me as much as I love him. And that helped us.
But in 2019, Carlos was on a streak of refusing to take his medication. And without that baseline, things became even more difficult.
In those 3 months, they take him into 7 different hospitals. They keep him only for 2 days, 3 days. They told me that they can keep him for no more time, you know, because the insurance don't allow them more time.
Then one day in November, things got a little bit scary. After 3 nights of no sleep, she smelled something burning. Carlos was lighting trash fires in the backyard, and he wouldn't respond to her questions. Antonieta felt like this was out of her league. So she picked up the phone.
I forgot totally. I forgot who to call. Okay? And that was my mistake.
Because she was so tired, she forgot about the mental health hotline numbers pinned up on her refrigerator. Instead, she dialed 911.
I called them for help, but they come like a SWAT. They come about 10 police cars and like a 20 or 25 persons. They make a big commotion, you know. I said, why you gonna do that? You know, I just need him to get to the hospital. And they say, no, we don't gonna take him to the hospital. We're gonna take him to another place.
By other place? They meant the Twin Towers jail. Antonieta says she feels guilty for being unprepared and making the phone call that set things in motion.
He don't deserve to go to prison. You know, he don't do nothing because he wants to do it. He's doing that because he's sick. But they got the gun. They got the badge. What can we do? All I can say, you know, don't shoot him. Because in so many cases, you know.
You're probably bracing yourself for what comes next in Carlos's story. But in this case, there's good news. The tragic ending we've heard way too many times didn't come to pass.
Hello?
Hi, Carlos. It's Sarah.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Do you still feel like doing an interview today?
Yeah.
That's my reporting partner on this story, Sarah Short, talking to Carlos during the summer of 2020, almost a year after he was arrested.
How's it going?
Good, just watching YouTube.
And as you might be able to guess, they don't have YouTube in jail. It took more than 5 months and some help from his family, but Carlos found his way to a better situation. When the virus hit, L.A. released 5,000 people from jail, and he was part of that wave.
Yeah, the whole experience of being in jail, it was just scary for me enough, not knowing when I was going to get out. They ended up just sending me to a program.
Carlos is in a supportive housing facility where he has his own bedroom and a smartphone. He's allowed to smoke cigarettes. He sleeps a lot and doesn't really do too much in terms of rehab, but he takes his pills and stays safe. He has ambitions to one day be a video game programmer.
I look forward to having a job and going to school and chilling with my friends. I look forward to seeing my mom and seeing my dad. Just having a normal life, you know?
The longer Carlos stayed in jail, the more his chances at that normal life would have declined. Job prospects, housing opportunities, even life expectancy is lower for people who've been incarcerated. And it doesn't just affect them.
When one person is incarcerated, it's not just that one person. It's the entire family. It's their loved ones.
Diana Zuniga is a longtime community organizer in Los Angeles. She's also Carlos's cousin.
For our family, we've had multiple people incarcerated, so the impact of that on the generations after them has been really felt.
Diana's father has been locked up for most of her life. Carlos's father has also been in and out of prison.
Many of our loved ones, especially the men in our family, have been incarcerated, and some of them have been diagnosed with mental health needs or trauma issues, and it was hard for my family to then see the next generation of men go through similar things. And, you know, that next generation was my cousin Carlitos.
That personal experience has driven much of Diana's activism, which is focused on creating community-based alternatives to incarceration. Carlos's housing situation is one example. She helped him find his way through the system into a more humane environment.
It's really seeking to look at how we can give that person care in the community as opposed to incarceration at every point in the system.
Diana admits revamping the entire structure is a big task. Los Angeles's criminal legal system is massive, but progress is being made.
In LA County, we have about 280 judges on any given day who are hearing criminal matters.
Peter Espinoza is a former judge himself at the LA County Superior Court. When he stepped down from the bench back in 2016, he says around 30% of judges' calendars involved inmates in mental health housing inside jail.
And there was virtually no resources available to judges who are looking for a way to care for individuals without keeping them in the jail or sending them to prison.
To be clear, there is mental health care inside LA jails. Remember, Twin Towers Jail, where Carlos Zuniga was held, is advertised as the largest mental health treatment center in the entire United States. But
you can't get well in a cell.
People with mental illness are the so-called frequent flyers of the system. Their untreated behaviors land them in and back out of jail again and again.
The jail is overcrowded. The clinicians who are trying desperately to care for ill people in the jail are understaffed, under-resourced.
Espinoza took a job directing the newly created Office of Diversion and Reentry, or ODR. ODR's aim is to create a web of other options for people with mental health or substance abuse issues. That includes sentencing alternatives, drug treatment, and perhaps most importantly, housing.
We make a commitment to them that we will house them for life.
I just want to make sure you heard that.
We will house them for life.
ODR's program pulls homeless people with a serious mental health disorder out of jail and puts them into housing with medication and services, if necessary, for the rest of their lives. Espinoza says the cost is about $40,000 a year per person. It costs more than five times as much to care for them in jail.
Many of these people will not require housing for life, but some of them will. Some of them will so that they don't return to homelessness, so that they don't return to untreated mental health, untreated mental illness, and the cycle begins.
In the first 5 years or so, ODR has taken more than 6,000 people out of jail and put them into community services. And the early results are pretty promising. A RAND Corporation study found after a year in the program, 71% of people stayed in ODR housing, with a recidivism rate of only 14%.
Those are remarkable numbers for recidivist behavior.
And his office isn't operating alone. under a new countywide philosophy of care first, jail last, a progressive board of supervisors is working on plans to close a jail in 2021. County agencies across the board are being reshaped to help keep people out of the criminal legal system. Then, in November, LA voters elected a new progressive district attorney and approved Measure J.
Vote yes on Measure J.
Because we believe that racial justice is healthcare. Racial justice is housing. And racial justice means care, not incarceration.
The measure requires at least 10% of the county's general fund to be spent on community investment and alternatives to incarceration. That could end up being upwards of $500 million a year. And none of that money can go to law enforcement. Instead, it can fund the kind of program that's kept Carlos Zuniga out of jail. His cousin Diana says the public's appetite for change surged in 2020. The coronavirus seemed to spark some long-absent compassion.
People really witnessing how COVID-19 is taking the life of so many people and how that is actually then happening within jails, prisons, and detention centers. And finally, there's this connection of health and justice that organizers have been lifting up for a long time.
When the pandemic hit, it jump-started ideas that were already working their way through the system.
This is a pivotal moment around health and justice concerns that people can't ignore anymore.
That unexpected rush of political will, along with funds generated by Measure J, could keep that momentum rolling in a post-pandemic world.
Thanks to Andrew Stelzer for that story. It comes to us from KALW Radio and was edited by Lisa Morehouse and co-reported by Sarah Short. The reporting was supported by the National Geographic's Emergency Journalist Fund and the Pulitzer Center. The pandemic has brought out people's compassion at the grassroots level as much as in political organizing. Up next on Reveal, neighbors helping neighbors. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. The past year has hit the country hard in so many ways. We've seen record numbers of people losing jobs, having trouble paying rent, or going hungry. But at the same time, there's been an explosion in the growth of mutual aid. From community-free fridges to diaper drives to direct cash donations, neighbors and communities all over the country are stepping up to help people through. Now, it's not like mutual aid is a new concept in the U.S. Just think about the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program or immigrant benevolent societies. But in this recent resurgence, many people are discovering this type of organizing for the first time. Sarah Thungum Matthews, who lives in New York, says it was a sense of impending doom that kicked her into action. Last March, just before shelter-in-place orders were announced, she was watching the news come out of China and Italy.
And I just thought, this is going to be awful. We're very possibly in New York City going to be where Italy is in 14 days.
Sarah was worried about herself, but also for her neighborhood. Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. She thought about her next-door neighbor.
He's an elderly gentleman, not in the greatest of health. And I just thought about him, but I also thought about all the people like him on all the blocks of the city. And the thought that appeared in my mind in this sort of like neon red light was, we need to get organized quickly, online, and by geographic proximity.
She set up an online messaging network through the platform Slack, but she didn't know if her plans would work.
But then I just kept thinking about the urgency that I'd been feeling. And my partner and I walked around our neighborhood for 10 to 12 blocks, putting up little flyers. And in the first 4 hours, 60 people joined. That was the first day. The second day, you know, it was like noon, like not even the end of day, and there were 100 people. The third day, there were 200 new people who joined.
The Slack network quickly formalized into a mutual aid group called Bed-Stuy Strong. They're now a network of over 4,000 local people who are supporting their community during COVID-19.
One way that I talk about mutual aid to the relatively like uninitiated is I say, hey, this is not a new thing. Mutual aid is as old as humanity itself. You know, mutual aid is what's practiced in my like home village of South India, where they say, oh, the neighbors, you know, in the next village, like had the flood wash away their homes, like we need to help them. Like it's not optional to take care of each other.
Sarah says that since they started, they've made roughly 19,000 grocery deliveries in central Brooklyn. They've also branched out into things like medication delivery, and their volunteers are constantly finding ways to fill needs that continue to arise.
There are Bed-Stuy Strong neighbors who are organizing like trash cleanups around the neighborhood because, you know, there've been cuts by the Department of Sanitation. Folks have done census outreach, voting electoral work. There are folks who over the summer organized an AC donation exchange drive for our elderly neighbors who sort of ran the risk of like getting really ill because of heat.
And as they've grown, Bed-Stuy Strong is also making new connections with like-minded groups.
And so one thing that I'm really thrilled about is that we months ago entered into this partnership with the Brooklyn Packers, who are a Black-owned, worker-owned co-op, who just are incredible.
A warehouse just south of Bed-Stuy in Brownsville is where food distribution co-op Brooklyn Packers does its work. This cold Friday morning, fresh food is being counted, sorted, and packed into individual bags for the weekend's deliveries. Brooklyn Packers was founded in 2016, but has grown rapidly during the pandemic. They now work with 10 neighborhood mutual aid groups, sourcing and packing groceries for people all over Brooklyn.
So you're getting your leafy greens, you're getting your vegetables, there's chicken in the bag, there's rice, there's beans, there's pasta, there's tomato sauce.
Kelvin Tate is director of operations at Brooklyn Packers and also co-founded his own neighborhood group last April, East Brooklyn Mutual Aid.
We wanted to make sure that we started off with taking care of the people that lived on our blocks, two blocks away, just in a little community that we've already made.
The group was initially pretty small.
When I first started, our volunteers were my dad, my stepmom, my cousin, her 5-year-old daughter, and my stepbrother. Those were our first volunteers for the first month and a half.
Gradually, neighbors on other blocks joined in. And when they realized help was needed in nearby neighborhoods, they kept expanding out.
You know, our volunteers are parents and teachers and people that have just moved here or want something to do, people that own their own businesses that want to support in any way that they can. Our volunteers are people at our elected officials' offices that are rounding up PPE for us and delivering it to us because they know we need it. Our volunteers are community. They're our neighbors, they're our friends, and our families.
And now, along with groups like Bed-Stuy Strong, they're leveraging the power of communication and strength in numbers across the whole city.
We have a cross-borough mutual aid network, which is just a giant WhatsApp group chat. We share resources, we share food, we share ideas, we share tech, we share volunteers sometimes if we need to. Unfortunately, the government hasn't given us resources. We've built infrastructures and operations that have served our communities over the last 8 or 9 months, and we've done that together.
I see participating in mutual aid as a kind of human development process that helps people become more compassionate, cooperative, and skillful participants in society.
Neil Gorenflot is the executive director of the nonprofit Shareable, whose mission is to empower people to, well, share.
Mutual aid is practicing democracy with a small d, the grassroots kind of democracy, right? And citizenship, really.
Shareable has put out a film, book, and podcast series called The Response, all about building collective resilience in the wake of disasters. And COVID-19 has certainly been the biggest disaster we've seen in generations.
The pandemic was a powerful catalyst because it put every human on the planet at risk at the same time and at a time when we're all connected, almost all of us are connected by digital networks. This allowed mutual aid to actually go viral. And I haven't seen anything like this in my lifetime or know of a precedent.
Neil says the explosion of mutual aid during the pandemic has shown that people can't always rely on institutions or governments to help them.
You know, our nation is so divided that we failed to respond to this pandemic effectively. We had all the resources and knowledge to do it, and we didn't do it, right? We're paying an extremely steep price in lives and treasure for this national family dysfunction. So I think the lesson of COVID-19 is that we need to rebuild our democracy from the ground up, or we won't be able to overcome the many challenges we face in the 21st century.
Neil says the government needs to do a better job of supporting its citizens. So mutual aid shouldn't be a substitute for what the government is supposed to do. But he says that neighbors helping neighbors, that has to be part of the solution.
We really have to go back to basics and rebuild our communities with these kind of ideas in mind. As the African proverb goes, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Kenneth Susie produced that story. Our lead producer for this week's show is Najib the Mighty Amini. Jen Chien and Laura Starcheski edited the show. Thanks to producer Pamela Kirkland for her work on our vaccine and fast science stories. Special thanks to the University of Virginia Health for their help on Dr. Tyson Bell's story. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Score and sound design by the dynamic duo Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. That helped this week from Brett Simpson. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson, and remember, there is always more to the story.